Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, located on your FM dial in the Portland metro area at 90.7, in the Columbia Gorge area 91.9, and in Willamette Valley 100.7. You're listening to More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. I will fly solo this morning. Celeste is unable to be with us this morning, but with you and with our guests, we will have an interesting program. My name is Cecil Prescott, and the time is approximately 7:40. Today is Monday, January 30th, 2005. I hope all is well with you this morning and that your weekend was a good one. Well, lots been happening in the news, and lots have been happening within our community. The president, I believe, will address the nation tomorrow to talk about the State of the Union. We will anxiously await to see what he has to say. Prior to that, we thought it might be interesting to talk this morning about our economy, more specifically about what happens to people when they retire, what happens to their benefits. Many of us are aware of many corporations such as United and other airlines who have made changes in their benefit packages, which impact thousands of citizens. And indeed, it has changed the way in which we think about security and also about our future. While I believe the president may or may not talk about Social Security and on his State of the Union delivery tomorrow, I believe that all of us need to be concerned about what happens when we retired or are no longer able to work. So joining us in a few minutes will be Dr. Christian Wheeler, who is a senior economist at the Center for American Progress. Many of you might be aware of this think tank, which offers insights and articles from a progressive view on the economy and on other social issues. So we will have Dr. Wheeler, who will join us shortly. In the meantime, I want to encourage those of you who have announcements of events or activities that might be of interest to the community to give us a to drop us a line here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214, I believe, and let us know about a activity that is happening in the community that you would want others to know. KBOO is your community radio station and your voice to others. So let us help assist you to get the news out about activities, actions, and things that are happening that people ought to know. Many of us are aware of how limited informations we get from the news sources, and this is an opportunity, a community radio station, for you to participate more fully in not only making sure that the news are is delivered, but that people will have news that is helpful, that can make an impact on their daily lives. So please feel free to drop us a line if you have an activity or an event with your community organization or group. And again, our mailing address here is 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, zip 97214. And then we will be able to share your news and information to those within the community. Now, today is January 30th, 2006. I'm still saying 2005, but it's January 2006. As we mentioned just a few seconds earlier, the president will be addressing the nation, I believe, and indeed the world, with his annual State of the Union message, which I think is constitutionally mandated. I think I need to review that. But we will not, we may turn and focus on the president's speech and speculate what he may or may not say. But one thing I think we might want to talk about is the state of our economy, more specifically about what happens when we retire. Joining us this morning is Christian Weller, who is the senior economist at the Center for American Progress. He specializes in Social Security and retirement income on the Federal Reserve and international finance. Prior to joining the American Progress, he was on the research staff at the Economic Policy Institute, where he remains today a research associate. He has worked extensively, and his publications have ranged from universal banking in Germany, Belgium, and Poland. He has appeared in publications ranging from Cambridge Journal of Economics and the Journal of International Business Studies to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and even the USA Today. He's often been cited and a frequent guest on many news programs. He holds a PhD from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Good morning, Dr. Weller. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Susan.
We mentioned earlier that the president will be addressing the nation, the State of the Union, tomorrow. And I believe, was it last year or the year before last when he made the splash around his so-called Social Security reform? And I was wondering whether or not you have a sense whether or not he will even touch that subject in his speech tomorrow evening.
The president made in the past a big deal about what he calls ownership society, and the privatization of Social Security was a big part of that. And that clearly came out after his reelection. He made that the centerpiece of, wanted to make that a centerpiece of his first year, his second term, which we just finished. Now, the problem for the president was that he talked about Social Security and his ideas of reforming Social Security, namely privatization, and the country just simply wasn't buying it. So I think the appetite by the public, but also by Congress, to see a big, bold initiative, what the president would describe as big, bold initiative on Social Security, massive new debt, massive benefit cuts, is just not there. So I think the president will stay far away from both Social Security as well as anything that reeks of massive new changes to any existing programs. Having said that, the president will probably talk to some degree about health care, but also to talk a little bit about pensions. But what he means by pensions is he may throw in a sentence like, this government is committed to hold companies to the promises they made to their retirees, which is kind of a buzzword. Behind that is actually a major disagreement between progressives and conservatives. The other part that he may push is for more tax cuts to increase savings incentives, especially for high-income earners. That has been a perennial favorite of the president. I don't think it will be front and center of his presentation. I think we will see a lot of small initiatives, and rolled into those small initiatives, maybe some retirement savings ones. But given the experience of what we saw in Social Security, I don't think there will be big initiatives, and I don't think Social Security will be part of that speech.
I see. We're speaking this morning with Christian Weller, who is the senior economist at the Center for American Progress. One of the reasons we wanted to talk with you this morning is specifically around pensions. And you mentioned just previously in terms of the president might make an appeal for companies to fulfill their promises they made to their employees regarding benefits. And you stated that there's a distinction between what progressive understand that promises and what conservatives. Could you speak more about that, the differences of understanding of the promises that corporations might have made to their employees?
Well, I think everybody can subscribe to that sentence. Everybody here in Washington agrees that companies should be held to the promise that they made to their employees. After all, a pension is an earned benefit. It is a deferred compensation. People have already worked for that money, and they just said, okay, well, I'll take it later when I retire as a retirement benefit rather than wages today. Now, the question is, how do you get companies to honor that promise in the future? And when you talk to companies, it's very clear that what companies want is they want predictability. They don't want to get out of it. They clearly they sign on to it. In some cases, they do it voluntarily. In some cases, they do it through collective bargaining agreement. But they agreed to offer that pension. And so the question is, what is the best regulatory framework to make sure that companies can pay for that promise? And when you ask companies in all surveys, and I've testified with company representatives on the Hill, that what they say is really, like, what we need is predictability. We don't need lower costs. We're fine paying that money over time, but what we need is predictability. And the president, and that's kind of where I think progressives and conservatives part ways a little bit. I think we, in my proposals, in the proposals that others have made, is, well, okay, let's make sure that the companies pay regularly money into their pension plans, and that they do so until they're well-funded, and we make it really predictable for them, but we require them to really fund their pension plans well. The administration is less concerned about the predictability. In fact, all of their proposals make it less predictable for pension plans, and they are basically want them to fund. Basically, what the administration is proposing is, we don't care about predictability. We want the company to fund their pension plan as if they were shutting it down today. And that is philosophically a different ballgame, because it basically says, we don't think these things have a future. I mean, that's the conservative position. Mm-hmm. We don't think defined benefit plans, traditional pension plans, have a future. And so we want to make sure that when you shut it down, there's enough money in a bank. And my position, and that of many progressives, is we think these pension plans have served America's working class and middle class extremely well. They have lifted a lot of people into the middle class and retirement, and they have a real future if we get them right. And the way to get them right is to make sure that companies have a predictable contribution stream, and we just hold them responsible, and we just require that companies regularly contribute to these plans, regardless of the funding status in some cases. We just want them to put money into the bank whenever they can, or on a regular basis, so that it's predictable for the company, they know what's coming, and that the beneficiaries will have actually what is promised to them when they retire. And I think that's philosophically a completely different ballgame, because we think, many progressives think, that defined benefit plans, traditional pension plans, have a future, should be around for the long run, whereas I think the administration, or it's very clear that the administration thinks, these have no future, they shouldn't have a future, we should fund them up to a certain point and then just get rid of them.
Now, what do you in terms of conservatives saying they don't have a future, is it that they don't want them to have a future, or they think that because of the economy, companies or corporations won't be able to pay out those benefits when younger employees retire?
Well, to be honest, a company, because it's an earned benefit, you're already earning the money when you work for it. And
right.
The company is supposed to put them, let's say, like 10 cents on a dollar for each hour that you work that you earn into the bank right then.
Yes.
And the administration sees this differently. The administration, I think that goes back to the Social Security fight, has made it very clear that it disdains any type of defined benefit plan, any kind of employer guarantee of benefits, be that through Social Security, be that through health plans, be that through traditional pension plans. In all of those instances, the administration has really tried to move as far away as possible from any employer guarantee. And the problem with that is the employer, through a pension plan or through what is called a welfare plan, basically a healthcare plan, has a much better ability to absorb the risks by spreading the risk across a larger group than the individual has. And it actually makes sense to keep those risks, retirement risks and healthcare risks, with the larger group, the population as a whole in Social Security, all current and former employees, and their pension plan and health plan, then shift them onto the individual. And I think that's really where the difference is, who should bear the risks. And the administration has made it very clear through their initiatives, and you'll see more of that in State of the Union, on health care, on pensions, on Social Security, that they think the individual should share the risk, whereas we think either the society as a whole should share the risk, or a group of current and former employees, and through the employer basically, should share the risk, and that is more appropriate for a pension plan to manage your risk than for the individual.
In terms of who should bear the risk, you know, at one point in time, defined benefits were seen as something that workers contribute in, and that was part of their package. In recent decades, or more recently, there's been that shift where as you suggested, the individual takes responsibility, and we have the focus on defined contributions such as 401k plans. Could you say something about the distinctions between these defined benefits and defined contribution plans in terms of risk?
Yes. Under a traditional defined benefit plan, when we talk United Airlines or Ford or GM, when you hear these names, when you talk about pensions, what we mean is defined benefit plans. And how they work typically is you receive a guaranteed benefit, a promised benefit, that is coupled to your age and to years of service. So a typical formula would say you would get 1.5% of your final salary for each year of service. So you stay with a company for 30 years, you get 45% of your last earnings from the company as your annual pension. So to give you an example, if you retire, to make this easy, with $100,000 in your earnings, which is fairly high, but like just to make the math easy, let's say like you earn $100,000 just before retirement, your pension will be $45,000 a year if you have worked for the company under this formula for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that is guaranteed from the company regardless of, and the company will contribute money over years to make sure that there's enough money in the pension plan to pay you those $45,000 every single year until you die. There is no risk for you. You don't have to worry about the risks of how the pension plan does while you're working. I mean, you don't have to make investment choices. You don't have to worry about the costs of investing. You don't have to worry about a stock market drop. Basically, that's all with a pension plan, its goal with the company. And by the time you retire, you also don't have to worry about running out of money before you die, because that pension is guaranteed for life. And if you pass before your spouse does, then your spouse gets a survivorship benefit.
Yes.
Often, these plans also include some sort of a disability benefit. So they have a number of other benefits that reduce your typical risk. They're extremely good savings vehicles for individuals. Now, those are the traditional pension plans, the defined benefit plans that you hear a lot about in the press. The defined contribution plans, the 401ks, they have a lot of other names, 403bs, 457s, IRAs, and so on and so forth. But what they do is basically the employer gives you, in some cases, a match. You basically put in a certain amount of money, let's say 10% of your salary every month, and the employer may match that, let's say 4% or something like that, 3%, 4% of your savings. And you have to worry as the individual about the investment choices. You have to check the costs of how much does it cost to invest in this fund versus this fund. And by the time you retire, you then have to see, like, okay, well, do I want to manage my money myself, make sure that I have enough money for the time I expect to live, or do I go and buy an annuity from an insurance company so that I get a monthly benefit guaranteed for life from an insurance company? Again, I have to worry then about the cost that adds to pay to the insurance company, and so on and so forth. All of those, and all of a sudden, there's no insurance here. There's no insurance that against the market dropping precipitously before you retire. There's no insurance that you run out of money before you during retirement before you die. So all of the risks that essentially the employer absorbs in the traditional pension plan are all under the individual in the newer 401k plans. The problem is, let me just make that one last point on 401ks. We don't know how good they are because they're fairly young.
Mm-hmm.
They have been around for about 20 years, a little over 20 years, and that is not a mature pension plan. A mature pension plan is once a whole generation has actually worked and saved and then retired under that pension plan, that would be 35 years. So we won't know how good 401ks are for the next, let's say, 15, 20 years, but we already know that they have big problems. And the biggest problems for them are they're extremely costly and they're shifting risk onto the individuals.
We're speaking this morning with Christian Weller, who is the senior economist at the Center for American Progress. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial. We invite those of you who might have questions or comments for Dr. Weller to give us a call in a few minutes. Our phone numbers are 503-231-8187. We're speaking this morning on the future, I suppose, of pensions as we've known them, and where do we go from here? Dr. Weller, you've written about not only Social Securities and benefits, but also issued some proposals. And you've written on something called, I believe, a cash balance plan. Could you explain what that is and how that might impact some of the issues you addressed earlier?
Yes. The cash balance plans, as I said earlier, the typical formula of the way benefits are calculated is under typical pension plan, defined benefit pension plan, is you get 1.5% of your last earnings for each year that you work with a company. So you work for a company for 30 years, so you get 1.5% for each year, so you get 45% of your last earnings by the time you retire. The cash balance plan is somewhat different. You get for each year of service a fixed amount of your earnings credited to what is called a notional account. Basically, the pension plan behaves, at least to the beneficiary's eyes, just like a 401k plan. You get 10% of your savings, for instance, credited to an account, and then the account grows at a predetermined interest rate, let's say prime rate plus 1% or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It may look initially like a 401k plan, but it is still one big fund. The interest rate is guaranteed year to year. Also, if the employer goes bankrupt, and this is very important, if the employer goes bankrupt and all of a sudden can no longer make contributions to the pension plan is insured through the government institutions that insure pension plans, which 401ks are not. Also, their survivorship benefits, you can often get a cheap annuity through cash balance plans. Cash balance plans are what is called hybrids because they are under the law treated like traditional pension plans. That's why they have the insurance to the government. But at the same time, they look to the participant like more like a 401k plan because they have this notional account balance. They're like you get an account statement every so often that tells you how much money you theoretically have in that account. They're very attractive. Employers really like them. Employees seem to like them because they're much easier to understand for the employee which is a big question for employers. They provide this benefit to the employees. They want to make sure that the employee they want to make sure that the employee understands what that benefit is worth. And so having that account vehicle, the individual account vehicle, is very important. But again, these cash balance plans under the law are considered pension plans. They're insured like pension plans, and they're basically the risk is spread still among all participants.
We're speaking this morning with Dr. Christian Weller, who's a senior economist at the Center for American Progress. He has written extensively on topics such as the Federal Reserve, retirement income, and the international finance. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. And just as I was saying all of those numbers, I'd lost my train of thought. Let me try to recollect. In terms of the changes in the economy, one thing that we often hear is that the economy is changing, and the language we often hear from conservatives is that we ought to have something like an ownership society or investment society. And in point of fact, it seemed when they make their case, shifting the responsibility or the risk on the individual seems to be a good thing. Are progressives, are conservatives better able to share their, to persuade, or is it that progressives have been unable to make an adequate argument in favor of of a different way of looking at benefits?
Let me just say, like, I think that the term ownership society mm-hmm. is a good term. I have no problem with advocating more wealth creation, especially where we don't see it, where we've been lacking as a society, and especially among minority households, but also lower and moderate income households, single women. We're really, because wealth creation in all its forms, home ownership, a retirement savings account, just a checking account or a savings account, are important vehicles. They're very important insurance mechanisms, just in case something goes wrong, or, again, for retirement. It is an insurance. It's an opportunity, and we clearly need to think about that. But there are two obstacles here that conservatives are building up. The first one is risk is really an obstacle for people to save, because it can high risk can destroy a lot of wealth, as we've seen in the last few years. When the stock market crashes, when the market goes down, it destroys a lot of wealth with it. So greater risk exposure is actually an impediment to wealth creation. So spreading out risk, and we've seen this for America's middle class in the past, the biggest two instances of wealth creation are both Social Security and traditional pension plans. So on those have spreading the risk among a lot of individuals and not shifting it onto the individual. So that, I think, is very crucial. The other part is also that I think the let me just make one more point on uncertainty on risk. I think the reason why the president failed with his efforts to privatize Social Security in 2005 was that the American public generally does not want to have more risk. I think the public generally does not like to manage the risk. It generally, the vast majority of people want to make sure that there is a good, solid base of benefits, Social Security, pensions, health care, for them there, that they don't have to manage their risks themselves. There are very few people who are willing to take a lot of risks. So I think shifting risks onto the individual is politically very unattractive. Mm-hmm. And the other part is also, I think, economically it makes very little sense. It kind of keeps people from saving a lot. The other part is that whenever the president talks and conservative talks about the ownership society, what the next step is, their policy proposal is typically tax incentives. Mm-hmm. And the tax incentives that conservatives, and we'll hear more of that in the State of the Union when it comes to health plans, the way health tax incentives are structured is it's basically the contribution to a health savings plan or a 401k plan or something like that are tax deductible. Mm-hmm. That means if your marginal tax rate is 35%, for each dollar that you are putting into an account, you get 35 cents from the government. Yes. If your marginal tax rate is 15%, you only get 15 cents. Mm-hmm. You got to remember a lot of low and moderate income households pay no federal income taxes. Their income is too low. So they get absolutely nothing from the government under those proposals. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. The households where we see the biggest shortcomings in terms of benefits and wealth, yes, low and moderate income households, will see the smallest benefits proportional to the income from what the president is proposing. And I think these upside-down benefits that we're giving a ton of benefits, I think on the 401k plans we're giving to the top 5% of income earners, we're giving 40% of tax incentives. The way that we have structured these tax incentives, especially benefiting high-income earners, is really not helping America's middle class. It's not helping to improve pensions. It's not helping to improve health insurance. And I think that's the wrong path. It's irresponsible government management of government resources to give money to people who already have all the benefits that they need and all the savings that they need, to give them the biggest tax incentives.
You've written recently rather extensively around the America's middle class and the crisis of the American middle class. And you mentioned, you touched briefly on such issues such as healthcare costs also. Could you say something? The term the middle class is I would think has changed in terms of our understanding of who is or what constitutes the middle class. When you write about the middle class, who are you talking about? Are you talking about people who've worked in companies for 20 years with their pensions? Are we talking about people both parents work and have a somewhat stable income? How would you define the American middle class?
Well, the way we define middle class is, in the research that I have done, is less so. I mean, some people will just simply put income levels somewhere and just say, like, this is the middle class. And there, it's a somewhat amorphous concept. But what we considered when we did the research on middle class is that we think there are certain consumption items, wealth items, that we think make for a decent middle class class lifestyle. That basically, if you want to look for a definition, provide for stable income over people's lifetime. And we consider in the research, we've considered basically four items. You could add a fifth to that. But the basic one is that you can afford transportation to and from your job. That includes public transportation and your car. That you own your own home. That you're able to pay for your home. And that you have health insurance coverage for you and your family. That you can afford a college education for your children, and you could include, if you wanted to, pensions, that you have enough money to basically save outside of Social Security through a pension plan. I think those are generally, I would think, the big characteristics, the big ticket items that we look at when we define middle class. If you can afford those items with your income, and that really varies from region of the country where you are, then you're probably middle class, because it allows you for certain, it allows for a certain stability. I mean, your home, some savings, health insurance, they're really, I mean, it's an insurance mechanism that prevents you from falling through the cracks if things go wrong. I think that's very important, but it also is a reflection of how much income you have relative to where you live. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a solid definition of middle class.
Okay. Great. We're speaking this morning with Dr. Christian Weller, senior economist at the Center for American Progress. We're speaking about the economy and issues that concerns all of us. Part of what we will hear tomorrow evening is the president address the State of the Union. And I've listened to a few of those, and usually there is some point near the beginning where the president will say something like, the State of the Union is good or strong or secure. Not that I think you are an advisor to the president, but what do you think he's been of the State of the Union, specifically around the economy?
The president will, you can look back through the speeches that he's made and his advisors have made over the last 6 months and to glean what he's going to say. He's going to say the economy is strong, companies are doing well, but we still have problems in for America's middle class. Many people are left behind when it comes to health insurance. People are losing their pensions. We haven't quite seen the wage growth that we wanted, although the president is not quite willing to admit the wage growth side. Mm-hmm. But the president and Jon Snow and others have admitted over the last 6 months that the economic gains over the last 2 years have not been equitably shared, that a large share of America's middle class has been left behind. The problem is the president, there's a huge difference between admitting there's a problem and finding a solution to the problem. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that the president's solutions to the problem are helping anybody. I mean, he's going to propose more tax incentives for retirement savings and health insurance. And as I said before, all of the incentives, all of these tax incentives are upside down incentives. You give mm-hmm. the biggest chunk, relatively speaking and absolutely speaking, the biggest chunk of tax incentives to high income earners who already save enough, whoever any benefits, and you give the smallest incentives and the smallest tax breaks to low and moderate income households, middle class families who don't have pensions or don't have pensions. So it really doesn't help to in terms of benefit coverage, what the president is proposing. The other parts, and you've got to remember, in terms of helping people have faster wages, there's two mechanisms that you can envision. And both are, I would say, strongly opposed by the administration. The first one is you can raise the minimum wage. The president has made it very clear he doesn't want to raise the minimum wage. It has been opposed to that for years. And the minimum wage hasn't been raised for 9 years at the federal level. So that's why you have minimum wage initiatives at a number of states now. The other part is you can give workers an effective right to unionize. That doesn't mean everybody has to have a union, but if workers want to join together and join a union, the majority of workers in the workplace votes for a union, then that's the democratic right under the law, under federal law, and that law should be enforced by the federal government, and the enforcement should have real teeth. And there are real proposals that get bipartisan support in Congress, but not support from the president. Not to say, like, everybody has to join a union, but to say, like, if the majority of workers in a workplace want to join a union, the federal government will enforce the democratic right to do that. And I think that's one of the biggest shortcomings of this administration, that it has failed to, A, enforce the existing law and to really push for stronger enforcement, better enforcement tools of federal law for an effective right to join a union.
Now, did you say that there is bipartisan support in terms of supporting workers' right to organize in the Congress, and the administration opposes those?
Yeah, it's called the Employee Free Choice Act. Mm-hmm. It was introduced a number of years in the House. It was introduced by George Miller from California. In the Senate, it was introduced by Senator Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts. But even when it was first introduced, it got a lot of co-sponsors from both sides of the aisle. So there is, because it's not about like, well, we don't like, when it comes to joining a union, it's often misrepresented as it's a vote between the worker and for or against the company. No, it is a vote of, do I want to represent myself in salary negotiations, or do I want to join a larger group and represent the group of workers in terms of salary negotiations and benefit negotiations, and sign a collective bargaining agreement, a contract, as a group of workers with the employer. And that is the federal law. It has been the federal law. It is our labor law since the Great Depression, that there is a federally protected right, democratic right, to do that. And it's really a question of how do you make sure that workers can actually take advantage of that right. And then the biggest problem is that there are theoretically penalties against violation of the law against the employer, but the penalties are paltry. I mean, it's very, very little. It takes forever to get the penalties through. And then the second one is when an employer actually has to pay the penalties, they're very, very small. So what the Employee Free Choice Act does is it speeds up the process to punish employers who have violated the law, and then actually make sure that the penalties have real teeth, that they actually hurt the employer, that the employers can't just simply shrug them off. And I think that if you want to see what can go wrong if the penalties are too low, is you just look at the mining disasters in West Virginia. Employers have often just simply shrugged them off because it's a $250 fine per incident. That's a little bit more than a speeding ticket, but for a big multi-million-dollar employer, that is an easy penalty to shrug off, and the same holds true in the labor law penalties. And I think you have to really look at worker protections under the labor law, under safety and health regulations, and look at those penalties and give the employers the right incentives, the really strong incentives, to uphold the law, to obey the law. That holds true, I think, when it comes to health and safety issues, but it holds also true when it comes to labor law. In upholding the democratic right of workers to vote for a union and bargain collectively.
We're speaking this morning with Christian Weller of the Center for American Progress. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. In your discussion about the Employee Free Choice Act and other mechanisms which will ensure that workers have a strong base to stand on to negotiate, one thing that you will hear in response oftentimes from conservatives is the word, well, this is class warfare, or a word similar to that. Do you think the American people are able to get beyond those rhetoric and able to not only recognize their need to organize, but able to do so in such a way that they are able to advocate for their own best interests?
Let me say this. I think the American people can do the math and can read the paper. And they see, like, the vast majority of Americans open the paper and have been opening a paper for the last 4 or 5 years, regardless of whether the papers are conservative or progressive. And what they see is that the companies have been rolling around in money, have been posting record profits, that the economy has been growing at an about average rate, and that their wages have not grown.
Mm-hmm.
They've barely kept pace with inflation, that they've lost pension benefits, that health insurance benefits, that even if they still have health insurance, the quality of that health insurance has declined. So I think America's, that the vast majority of America's middle class understands that things have gone extremely well for company and top executives and not so well for America's middle class, so that things have been uneven. Now, you might want to call this class warfare, or you can say, like, the middle class has not been able to share in the economic gains, whatever you want. But the problem is, for the economy, you got to make sure that America's middle class shares in those overall economic gains.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, that is also becoming an issue on Wall Street now, because Wall Street is looking at the stock market for the last 2 years, and what it sees is the stock market has been flat, despite record profits. And the reason for that is that Wall Street bankers, economists on Wall Street, understand that unless middle-class families have better benefits and better wages and more jobs, they cannot keep up their consumption. They cannot buy more homes, more products that they're making. And without more products, the profits will eventually, without more consumers, the profits will eventually evaporate. And that's certainly something that I think is driving even conservatives to say, okay, well, we got to make sure that we're going to help America's middle class share in the economic gains. And it's just a question of how you get there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my proposal is, let's look at effective right to join a union, because that's where it is. The money gets generated at the company level. A union at a company level can help to equitably distribute the economic resources of the company, so that the shareholders get their fair share, the executives get their fair share, and the workers get their fair share. The conservatives are more interested, which is very surprising, they're more interested in beefing up economic programs, government programs. It's very odd because conservatives are really, but their favorite program is to earn income tax credit, to really improve that. It's basically if you earn money and you work in the workplace, mm-hmm. but you fall below a certain income threshold, the government basically gives you money.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very costly proposal. Mm-hmm. I think it's a big government proposal. I have no problem with improving the earned income tax credit. I think it's a very good proposal. What I find odd is that this is the first step the conservatives are proposing.
Mm.
The second step that the question I have for my conservative counterparts whenever they propose it is, how do you want to pay for an improvement in their income tax credit while you're still giving tax cuts to high-income earners and corporations? Those two things don't typically go together. So I think it's often a very hollow proposal, because conservatives often know that the money is not there for that idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like, well, we would like to improve it, but we have already given all the money away in tax cuts. So I think in the current environment, I'm all for raising corporate taxes, letting the capital gains tax cuts run out, the dividend tax cuts, and using those funds to improve the social safety net and for progressive spending. But I think in the meantime, we also have to look at making the private sector work better and make the allocation of economic resources work better in the private sector. And I think the most efficient way, one of the most effective way of doing that, is to give workers an effective democratic right to join a union and bargain collectively.
We're speaking with Christian Weller of the Center for American Progress, and we have you for a few minutes, and I wanted for our last few minutes to talk about where do we go from here. More specifically, I recall a time in my father's generation who went to work, who worked for a a organization or corporation, and they worked for, you know, 20, 30 years and had a pension, and that was something they could count on. The economy is very different now, and, you know, we hear about things that were institutions, so-called institutions, United Airlines or motor companies who, things are changing. And for the last 20, 25 years, certainly since Reagan, we've heard of, cut the taxes on those with higher income. Now, apparently, this sort of Republican economics has been going on for 20, 30 years, 20 years at least, and things seems to be getting worse. Are we waking up, and are we able to challenge that Republican orthodoxy?
Well, I think you got to remember that there was a period of time, even under a Republican president and then followed by a Democratic president, where that was challenged. I mean, even Father Bush raised taxes. Mm-hmm. And understood that you have to be responsible with the government's resources, and that wouldn't necessarily hurt growth. But I think right now we have such an extreme unevenness in terms of sharing of economic resources, mm-hmm. leaving the vast majority of America's middle class behind, and I think that's a real wake-up call. What strikes me is when I open papers that are typically considered conservative, especially Wall Street papers, and Wall Street newsletters, how many Wall Street analysts are saying, we got to make sure, first they said, like, we got to make sure that we create enough jobs in this economy. And now they're saying, we got to make sure that people are getting paid enough that they can actually buy the product that they're mm-hmm. making. Because without that, there's no incentives for companies to invest. Without investment, there won't be growth in the future. And without growth, there won't be revenues and profits. So ultimately, if we don't help America's middle class, it will hurt America's companies' bottom line. And I think that's really the wake-up call that people are getting right now, because if you look at the last 5 years, all that has been driving the economy is massive amounts of corporate consumer debt. Households have been borrowing on their credit cards and their home equity lines and their mortgages mm-hmm. as much money as never before, and that really is coming to an end, and it's hurting the economy, and it's hurting corporations, and we're really – like I think there's a coming together among smart people saying, okay, well, this has to change, and what are the mechanisms to change it? And I think one of the reflections is that Walmart right now, for instance, is calling for a higher minimum wage. I think that's breaking new ground for that company. I don't think Walmart is going to turn into a progressive company anytime soon, but mm-hmm. clearly it is already pushing in that direction because they understand that higher income means higher profits for corporations writ large. And I think those are the first few steps, but the problem is so big that ultimately those first few steps will lead to more steps. And I think along the line there will be higher minimum wage, more money for earned income tax credits, more money for health insurance. You look at Massachusetts, run by a Republican governor. Mm-hmm. Mitt Romney has just proposed basically a massive state government program to ensure every citizen of Massachusetts. So there is an understanding across the country that something needs to happen to help America's middle class feel safer, have more money, have better benefits. And I think the bipartisan efforts will spread throughout the next few years over across the country. And a lot of them will happen probably at the state level rather than the federal level.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time this morning to talk with us, to give us some information about the state of our economy, and also for ending with a helpful note. We'll listen to the president's speech tomorrow. I don't anticipate too much in terms of surprises, but as people such as yourself continue to write and educate the American public, I'm sure change is on the way.
I hope so. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Dr. Christian Weller, who is the senior economist of the Center for American Progress. Tomorrow evening, January 31st, the President of the United States, George W. Bush, will fulfill one of his constitutional duties by addressing the nation and the world about the State of the Union. We wonder what he will say and what proposals he will have. If, for example, you had a chance to speak with the president, or what would you suggest that he say or do? I'm sure the president will not call me up and ask for my opinion, but we have the opportunity to reflect as a people, as a community, about the State of the Union. Throughout the nation, in many, many communities tomorrow evening, people will be gathering in small groups to listen to the president and to respond about to his message. Whether or not you will participate in the small group discussion, certainly you have an idea and viewpoints about the State of the Union. So we want to encourage you to give us a call now at 503-231-8187. And among the questions we would like for you to address, if you could speak to the president, what would you tell him to say about the State of the Union? And if you were able to make changes in the economy, what are some of the changes you will make? Some of you might have been at the Hillary Clinton gathering this weekend, and I'm pleased to say that the junior senator from New York did not get a free ride here. I'm interested in hearing if any of you participated in the gathering or the information sharing with the junior senator from New York. But those are just two things on our topic board this morning, and we're open to others. So again, our numbers are 503-231-8187, and we'll go to a caller. Good morning, and thank you for waiting.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well, and you?
I'm doing well.
What's on your mind this morning?
Well, if I had a question or maybe just comments that I would make to the President of the United States, I would first of all start off by saying how pleased I am with the work that he's doing and the progress, and encourage him to continue cutting our taxes, because I feel we're overburdened with our tax load. But he is making a difference, and I think in his last 2 years we're going to see a lot more tax cuts, tax breaks, so that we can grow our economy.
And what type of tax cuts are you in favor of, and that you encourage the president to make?
I am very much in favor of tax cut and tax break that he makes, both for the poor, for the middle class, for the wealthy, for all Americans.
But I think you have to be a little bit more specific, because I'm not familiar with the specific proposal you are talking to.
Well, I mean, just in general, I would like the president to cut taxes, okay, federal taxes across the board for everybody. Just lower our tax burden. You know, my taxes went down tremendously in the last 3 to 4 years, and I appreciate that, and I was able to hire more people. And so I'm just hoping that he continues to do that. And then I would just encourage him to keep a close eye on Iran and begin basically preparing our troops for war if they do not discontinue their nuclear weapons program. I think they are a larger threat than even Saddam Hussein was.
But let me ask, engage with you in a conversation specifically.
Yes.
About that. You argue in favor of continuing to reduce the tax burden,
yes,
but also you are certainly aware that a national budget has grown, and that part of it is due to the money we send to the Defense Department. Now, how are we, for example, able to confront these terrible things outside of our nations while continuing to lower our tax burden? How do we confront?
That's a good question. Number one, you are correct. The war has consumed a lot of our money. You are correct, and I do agree with you. However, I do believe when you cut people's taxes, and Reagan proved this, you do stimulate the economy. For example, when my taxes were cut, I was left in my book, my business, personally, I was left with a lot more money, which I used to invest in back into the economy, invest in hiring. I was able to hire three more people. So I think if taxes are cut across the board, it will stimulate the economy. It will actually produce more money when people like you and me are in control of their money as opposed to our federal government.
I think you personally
and me are a lot better with our money than our federal government.
Okay, well, you know, there's a little contradiction here because at one point in time, you know, conservatives talked about the federal government and how bad it was. But in point of fact, the federal government has grown tremendously under President Bush.
I agree 100% with you. I agree. I think the spending, okay, and there's two points here. The tax cuts, I believe, are very good. However, as a conservative, I do believe the spending is out of control, and I think that
what spending? Because I think the spending that has increased is in terms of the defense budget. So are you saying that's out of control?
I think spending for defense is very, very important. I do agree that we do need to protect our country. We do need to strengthen our military, strengthen our defense. However, I just read a report in the Wall Street Journal 2 weeks ago that there were 6,000 pork barrel projects that were introduced in the last legislation, which had nothing to do with spending on the military. For example, one of them was a $400 million bridge in Alaska going to one island servicing nothing.
In my opinion,
it was a pork barrel that the senator in Alaska wanted to push through to make him look good. And this is happening across the board both Republicans and Democrats.
But
I agree with you.
Okay.
I think the spending is out of control under this current administration.
Well, let us agree on one thing. I think we can agree that the spending is out of control, and that you mentioned the senior senator from Alaska and his so-called pork barrel.
And certainly
he's a Republican, and certainly that the Republican Party controls the White House.
Actually, he's a Democrat.
The Republican. Both senators from Alaska are Republicans.
Well, the senator that was proposing this was actually a Democrat.
Well, I was referring to the pork barrel. You were referring to Ted Stevens in terms of Alaska. But regardless of that, certainly spending has greatly increased with this administration. A large part of it is to the defense budget. So I think for those who claim to be conservative, we have to challenge you to say, well, let's be consistent. Are we for a large government or are we for a small government? And point of fact is that the federal government spending has increased, but the priority has shifted. So it isn't whether or not we want government to do things. It's what we want government to do. And that, I think, is the difference between conservatives and progressives.
I don't want the government taking care of me. I don't need their help.
Well, you do.
All I want is cut my taxes so that I can choose to allocate and use my money the way I.
Well, in point of fact, you do want the government to take care of you because you argue for an increased defense budget. So the government has some responsibility.
A very small part of the budget.
Well, the defense budget is very small. I think.
I shouldn't say it's a very small part. It's not the whole picture. Okay.
Well,
we're spending more. I'll tell you, we're spending more on welfare and supporting people who should get their butt all out of bed and get to work.
Well, no, that's inaccurate. I mean, if you look,
but there are a large majority Americans who are got their hand out, expecting the government, expecting people like me and you to support them day in and day out.
Well, point of fact,
I see him every day. You know, I'm going into Walmart.
Okay, wait. Federal spending in terms of social welfare programs has decreased in the last 20 years.
That's a point of fact.
The so-called welfare reform that has decreased. Housing allowance has decreased. Assistance to those who need help with paying heat and utility has decreased. So, in point of fact, those with their hands out, or with their hands of military contractors who just walk in and get whatever they want. But, you know.
Yes, but see, we need to protect our country, sir. In light of the enemies that we face in the 21st century, we live in a different world, and we do need to protect our country. We do need to protect, you know, our interests, so.
Okay. Well, you know, I
that's what I would say to the president. I would say continue what you're doing. You're doing a great job. Thank you very much for the two Supreme Courts that you nominated, you know, one.
Let me ask you a question that the president was unable to answer. One person wants to ask, President, would you do anything different? He's been in office for 6 years now, and you've just praised him endlessly. Maybe he's, you know, the.
He's I would say you've done a good job. With the Supreme Court justices, you've done a good job of the war. You've done a great job with tax cuts. Mr. President, let's cut spending.
And where do you cut spending?
Pork barrels, mostly pork barrels. Let's cut all social welfare.
Okay.
Let's give more businesses back to the. Let's give more money back to businesses. And when I say corporation, I mean I'm a corporation. I employ 15 people. Let's give money back to the businesses who employ 75% of the people in this nation.
Well, thank you so much.
50 employees or less are employed by small businesses.
Well, you know, I don't think we're going to disagree on those facts, but we do have some other callers online. I want to thank you for calling.
Thank you very much for your program. I appreciate it. Keep up the good work.
Okay, thanks. And you're listening to KBOO Portland. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. Our previous caller was praising the president for all that he is doing. And let's see what the next caller has to say to the president. Good morning. Thank you for waiting.
Oh, hi, Cecil. This is John. I just had to get online here. I was spitting BBs at this neo-fascist that this called. The people that create the wealth in this society are the working people. It's the businessmen who suck off these riches for their own personal benefit, and this guy is typical of that.
Mm-hmm.
Tax cuts for the rich or the businessmen don't help things. It's tax cuts for the poor and social services. People like this guy have sucked on the juice of society for years that they've forgotten who produces the wealth in this country. The poor working people work their butts off to produce this wealth that this guy's sucking on. And I'm just fed up with people like him.
Yeah, you know, John, what he mentioned was, like, he's an employer, he employs 15 people. If you had a chance to sit down and talk with them, what else would you say to him?
What else would I say to him?
Directly.
Directly? I'd say, have some consideration for the working people who work for you. Injured on the job or anything, he'll throw them out in the street. But people that work for him, and I don't know how long they have worked, I'd be interested to ask them that question. What's the longevity of his working force? I'll bet it's not very long.
Mm-hmm.
He has no consideration for his workers, and they're producing the wealth that he's earning.
Well, thank you, John, for calling and responding to our last caller.
Okay, you're welcome. Good luck.
Okay, have a great day. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. Tomorrow evening, the President of the United States, George W. Bush, will fulfill his constitutional duty by addressing the nation, by addressing the Congress. I believe that's what the Constitution say. What is he going to say, and what would you say to him or to the callers previously? Let's go to our next caller, and thank you for waiting. Good morning.
Oh, thank you, Cecil. Thanks so much. I have a few thoughts scrambling around here. But one I've just reheard recently by a former President Eisenhower, where he said he was his concern was that this nation would bankrupt itself in the vain search for security.
Hmm.
And I think we should look to see who is making, well, and, okay, wars don't make, oh, I mean, peace doesn't make money, but
yes.
Wars do.
Mm-hmm.
And see who's making the money. See who's making the money. Halliburton's making a ton of money, and so is the Carlyle Group. And we don't see anything about the Carlyle Group. You know, and that's one of Poppy Bush's little babies.
Yes.
And some of his best pals. And, you know, some of that has to be blown in a few of the family accounts as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I mean, maybe we would be better off just having states, you know, state governments and forget about the feds.
Mm.
Because, you know, all I see them doing is thieving from the rest of us. They lie, they cheat, they steal. At least that's what's been going on the past few years.
Right.
And I think there's a book that I would recommend to anyone, and it's by Michael Rupert, and that would be Crossing the Lexicon. Crossing the Rubicon. Sorry.
The Rubicon, okay.
Okay, I'm so sorry.
No problem.
And I'm trying to think and talk at the same time, doesn't always work.
Right.
Anyway, it's interesting because of all the tie-ins.
Yes.
With, oh my God, the tie-ins are unbelievable. And the tie-ins, it's unimaginable, but it is who all the Al-Qaeda is tied into.
Yes. Well, excellent.
And you think about the assassinations of the past, of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King, and, you know, the small planes that go down. I mean, there's just so much that goes on.
Wow.
And I think that people need to get off their dead ducks and start doing some research on 911.
Mm-hmm.
What really happened. You know, you can't be taking that big book that they're selling out there.
Right.
You know, on the government deal, because that isn't the true story. And there's much more to that people need to be researching and finding out. You know, the whole deal has been, how do we ram all this stuff down the American throat?
Right.
And it's the F word, the four-letter F word, which is fear.
Fear, wow.
And did that work well. Anyway,
hey,
you know, and I don't think anyone should be overtaxed, but, you know, I do believe that the welfare kings should have to kick in a little bit.
Okay. Well,
and you know who they are.
And the welfare kings, yeah.
You know who they are. Thanks, Cecil.
Hey, thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 is the Omo Variety Hour. Here an interview on the Israel and Palestine, the Hamas victory. They'll also have a discussion on the upcoming African Film Festival. At 10, Dr. Naaman will host Health Watch. He'll interview naturopathic physician Kimberly Winstar and Steven Sandberg Lewis on natural approaches to cardiovascular health. 10:30 is Earth Watch with Chris Andre, who interviewed Tyson Slocum, an expert on oil company profits, windfall profit tax available, about the ExxonMobil 2005 earnings report just out today. And 11 o'clock on Democracy Now, here an hour-long interview with Harry Belafonte, who has had some interesting things to say about the president in recent weeks. But in the meantime, we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, and thank you for waiting.
Yes, good morning. I would like to tell the president and the Congress that the country is already built. It was fully built 100 years ago, and that through industrialization and mass marketing, they've been destroying the quality of life of people, and the way to remedy this is to close the border completely of all immigration and declare global zero population growth. And then, since that would be a message to the world that we will all have better lives if we just maintain what we have, then the Congress and the President should look at a homesteading type law to provide income and living and social security for citizens here. And the idea behind that would be that you're home that you live in, you would not pay the high level of income tax on, and the taxes would probably be derived from sales tax only, no income tax, no property tax, and then what you would have is a climate where good businesses could thrive because people would all have a chance to become a businessman and or form co-ops where they provide goods and services, and it's the opposite of supply-side economics. It's demand-side economics where you create the demand by having buying power in the hands of everybody. Everybody's a businessman. Everybody's a homeowner. Everybody's a voter and a potential entrepreneur and creator and consumer.
I see.
But the consumerism would fall into place at the end. What they're doing now is they're trying to promote consumerism by growing the population,
mm-hmm.
but we're living in a country that doesn't seem very governable. They're having to spend lots of money on roadways and military costs to get oil out of the Middle East. It seems like we're in a society where we're quite anonymous and the police powers are getting stronger, and these are not good signs. It's the signs of sort of an industrial hell, a political science nightmare, and actually an illogical way to live where we're just sprawling all over what was once sort of a livable place, and they just keep wanting to promote more driving and fuel consumption and mass marketing. And somewhere in the last 20 years, we made the dangerous mistake of realizing that working with your hands is not a sign that you're a deficient person. And,
right.
and you know, actually, some of the most creative people, some of the most inventive people were, you know, manual workers, you know,
right.
artisans and architects and, you know,
sure.
great, great ideas come from working with your hands, but because of the influence of the Southern politicians who have always looked down on manual work, they've always looked at manual workers as some sort of servant who doesn't deserve a living wage, you know, put them in slavery, put them in servitude.
Sure. Well, you know, you've raised several really interesting points that we don't have time to talk about this morning in terms of your proposals, but I hope that at some point we'll have time to talk more and you can lay them out more for me.
Yeah, I'd like leftists to look at world history and examine the places in the world where they have decided to do zero population growth, and they've actually expanded freedom,
okay,
creativity.
Okay, well, we need to go into our next call. Thank you for calling and sharing your thoughts.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have a couple more callers. Let's see if we can get them in before the end of the hour. Good morning, caller.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm just fine this morning.
Okay, what's on your mind?
I wanted to comment about the caller a few ago who was called in to support the president, and I think that as progressives, we have commonly decided everybody has a right to their opinion, and I totally agree with that. What we're hearing from him is you had no right to an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It was only his opinion. You couldn't even get a word in, and I think it behooves all of us as progressives, liberals, whatever you want to call it, conservatives, to interject and say, no, that's not correct. And a good case in point was Senator Stevens from Alaska certainly has always been, is currently, and is chairman of the Transportation Committee, a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when people get into these mantras, they're like talking points that we see passed out, we need to challenge those.
Well, and you know, a couple of times when specifically around Senator Stevens, I tried to say that he was a Republican, the senior senator from Alaska, but it seems as if it just he didn't respond to that directly.
Oh, absolutely.
So
I'm not even quite sure he heard you.
Yeah. So in terms of challenging those who throw out these, you know, not facts, how do you interrupt them in a way in which they can hear you?
Well, I think you have to do it. Unfortunately, it's a little bit on the root side, but I think you have to do it in the exact same manner that he did, and that's that you keep pressing your point, or you ask him to hold on a minute or do something like that. It has to be, we have to come to grips with that, because I think we suffer from that, and it's unfortunate.
Yeah, and you know, one thing is, it's really difficult to do that when you're talking over the phone, because you, part of it, you don't see someone, so it's,
right.
it's somewhat easier to interrupt when you're physically
sure.
in their presence.
Yeah.
But yeah, keep us honest, and thank you for your call.
Well, I had one other point
oh,
I
sure.
want to make.
Go ahead.
And that's what I would say to the president. One story you had on earlier, the economist from the Progressive Institute,
mm-hmm.
When he talked about the fact that the middle class were not enjoying in the rewards of this building or flourishing economy. And then if you look at today's paper, where the quarterly profits for ExxonMobil set a record this year at
yes.
$10.7 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's some, obviously, if you look at it closely or even in a cursory manner, you can see that that's not balanced.
Mm-hmm.
And the gentleman that called in just before me that said, you know, working with your hands is not a sin, I totally agree with that. And there's some disconnect here between those two issues. And I would ask President Bush to balance those. Tell us why that is. Thanks.
Hey, thanks so much for those thoughts and those suggestions. And let's go to, I think I'll, oh, let's see. Okay, let's try to get this caller in and the next one real quick. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, taking a real conservative perspective again, since that was a very enlightening call, I'm very disappointed in George Bush
uh-huh.
as a conservative because, well, for one, we've totally, totally wasted hundreds of billions of tax dollars on a war scheme battling an opponent who, for all evidence before and after the war, was not a threat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that was the biggest single waste of our taxpayers' money that I have seen probably in my life.
Yes.
And at the same time, my concerns for security have been tremendously increased because the war has basically been the largest recruiting tool and has mobilized forces that philosophically hate the United States and has become the greatest single recruiting tool for what this administration calls our greatest enemy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So just on those two points alone, George Bush has been a horrible failure.
Well, that's interesting. I appreciate you raising those points and discussing them from a conservative point of view. I think that's
now,
helpful.
Now, the other thing is that, you know, this gentleman says that he's creating jobs, and he's got 15 employees.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that you would have asked him, since the cost, of course, of private insurance is far exceeding the wage growth in this country. Okay, the wage growth for the average worker is not keeping up with inflation and is probably way, way not keeping up with the cost of health care.
Yeah.
So the only way a worker can afford health care is to have an employer give it to you because we don't have the least expensive health care we could possibly have, which would be a national health care system. So I would have loved to have heard the question, the answer to the question, did he give health care to his employees?
Okay, well, next time I'll try to remember that. Hey, thanks for calling.
Okay, bye.
Hey, and last call. I'm really sorry we have maybe 45 seconds. Good morning.
Well, good morning. How are you?
I'm well.
Okay, listen, I thought you might want to hear from some bona fide retirees. My wife and I just retired.
Uh-huh.
She retired at 62, and I retired in July.
Mm.
We don't have any pension coming in. Right. We've been working class people our whole lives, but we planned for our retirement.
Right.
Okay. We did that by reducing our costs. Okay. For the last 5 or 6 years, we've been banking her salary. We've been banking mine and like living off hers. And our house is paid for. We have never ever owned a credit card, so we don't have any credit card debt. We have zero liabilities and like all assets. And the reason that we were able to do that, is because we never gave a nickel of our money to corporate America. So if you guys are planning to retire, live frugally, spend wisely, discern your wants from your needs, and it'll be a walk in the park. We have, between our two Social Security checks, we have more than enough money to live. Have a great day.
Hey, thank you for calling, and enjoy your retirement.
Well, thank you.
And you've been listening to KBOO Portland, More Talk Radio with Cecil without Celeste this morning. Stay tuned for the OMO Variety Hour and other programs. Stay well and have a great day.